9, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Welcome to We're All Gonna Die Radio, where we talk about the things in the news that might be scaring the bejesus out of you, and why you should or shouldn't be terrified about them. I am one of your co-hosts, Heather Williams. My partner in crime, John Wolfstahl, is on travel this week, and he's probably somewhere over the Atlantic as we speak. But we will carry on. We will persevere without him, and he will be back. Today, we are talking about the risk of nuclear weapons use in Ukraine, and I am thrilled to be joined by Mike Kaufman, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
So the slightly terrifying news this week comes from Jim Sciutto at CNN. He has a new book out that is called The Return of Great Powers, and he did an interview with Deep State Radio's fearless leader, David Rothkopf, a few days ago that you should definitely check out. But one of the more sensational findings of the book was that in late summer, fall of 2022, intelligence reports have indicated there was a higher risk of nuclear weapons use by Russia in Ukraine than previously thought, and specifically that this might be a false flag operation. This was also previously reported by the New York Times, and at my own institution, CSIS, we recently did a study finding a major shift in Russian nuclear narratives at this time. Also in the news this week, Putin made another reference to Russia's nuclear weapons, saying they're ready to be used if the existence of the state is at risk, but hasn't seen a need for it. It was also confirmed this week that Russian nuclear weapons have been moved to Ukraine. And also today is election day in Russia. So we wanted to unpack a lot of this news and talk more broadly about the role of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And I just couldn't think of a better person to have that conversation with than Mike. So turning to you, Mike, but before we jump straight into the news and nukes, I know that you just got back from Ukraine. So kind of just wanted to see what were your reflections on this most recent trip? Did they have any responses to some of Trump's recent statements encouraging Vladimir Putin to invade? And yeah, just kind of any takeaways you had.
Sure. I didn't hear much about Trump. What I will say is that in Ukraine, the leadership is currently actively working on stabilizing the front. The situation is obviously quite difficult. I would not say that it's dire, but it has been trending negatively, especially people can tell since the recent Ukrainian retreat from Avdiivka. The Russian military has captured that salient and is making incremental gains, although I think Ukraine is having a lot of success in stabilizing the front line right now. But a lot remains in question over the next several months. The first is the ongoing supplemental debate here in Congress, upon which hinges a lot of material assistance, right? Financial assistance and military assistance for Ukraine. Another factor is to what extent Europeans will be successful with some of their initiatives to buy ammunition externally outside of the European Union, the Czech initiative, because Ukraine is currently facing a very substantial fires disadvantage on the front line, around 5-1 or 6-1. And then inside Ukraine itself, the new military leadership is, you know, conducting internal audit, restructuring the forces, and is facing a significant deficit of manpower. And the mobilization law has been actively debated there for some months. And that's one of the critical factors to look to in the next couple of months to see if Ukraine can effectively address their own manning levels and manpower issues. And these are all interrelated, right? Because Ukraine, of course, looks to the United States, whether it's going to get funding, if the West is really going to support it, to get a sense of what its resources are going to be if it chooses to mobilize people, and then how many people should it mobilize. And there's a lot more involved in that in terms of, legal parameters, terms of service. There's a whole lot that's in entangled in the mobilization conversation and addressing manpower issues. And the bottom line of the Ukraine right now is trying to address the challenge of manpower, building fortifications, and of course, ammunition, equipment. And this latter part, we are particularly much more responsible, and Ukraine's much more dependent on the United States and Western countries for those. So a lot hinges on what happens in the next couple of months and the decisions sort of that we make and they make, which will set the course and the trajectory for the rest of this year and heading into 2025.
So just one more question on that then. I know about a month ago you did a podcast with War on the Rocks, and I should have also said you host your own podcast, The Russia Contingency. But I think it was about a month ago you were talking about how the Ukrainians were having a really hard time stabilizing the front lines. What do you think has changed between now and then that's made it, that's it allowed them to have a bit more success?
Well, I mean, to be frank, they had to withdraw and they had to retreat from Avdiivka, and they are still in a steady retreat, but the main thing that's changed is that the Russian offensive operation has been conducted since October. Russian forces have been pushing on several fronts, but the main operational axis was Avdiivka, seems to be culminating. And so it's likely that Ukrainian forces will stabilize the line sometime soon. And then the big question, of course, is what will happen when the Russian military launches the next set of offensive operations, which is probably bound to happen, if not later this spring than by the summer, since Russia holds the strategic initiative along most of the front line. And so that's kind of where we are right now. And this is going to be a very difficult year where Ukraine is going to be focusing on trying to hold Russian forces and exhausting them, basically trying to hold them down to incremental gains, reconstituting, rebuilding their military significant to some significant degree. That, of course, depends on the material assistance they get from Western countries. You know, and then also trying to expand a strike campaign against Russian critical infrastructure, Russian energy infrastructure, and the like. And you've seen a lot of that probably in the last couple of months. Even most recently, I think just yesterday, I saw a new set of strikes against Russian refineries by Ukrainian drones.
Mm. So also in the news this week had been the new, there was an intelligence report that came out about Russian conventional and nuclear capabilities. And one of the projections of that was that as Russia will have to rebuild its conventional forces, which have obviously been depleted and weakened, it will probably become more reliant on nuclear weapons during that time. So shifting to nukes, the story that I mentioned had said that in late summer, fall of 2022, that Russian military leaders, at least, were seriously considering the use of nuclear weapons. And when you hear that news, what was your reaction to it? If you could maybe set the scene a little bit for what was going on the ground at that time, and did you get a sense that there was a heightened risk of nuclear use?
So I'm assuming here we're talking about probably around October 2022.
You know, the timing is a really interesting question, because that's what I, from our report at CSIS, that was the timing that we had thought, but the book, the reporting that Jim Sciutto did suggested it might have been as early as August. So probably around the Kherson time, but that was news to me.
Yeah, so I only have my own impressions, right? I can't speak to whatever it is that Jim Sciutto is basing his writing on, or the other folks that, you know, typically quote, you know, senior government officials or whatnot, or whatever's released or leaked to them. But I'll give you my own impression, which is that there were two periods of relatively heightened risk or perceived risk of Russian nuclear escalation, or at least the fact, or the to put it more clearly, the perception that Russian leadership might consider nuclear use and that the Russian military leadership might propose it, or at least deliberations of that kind would begin. And of course, with great uncertainty as to how they would unfold and the choices that might be made. The first one was very early on in the war when the initial Russian invasion failed and Russian leadership looked very much taken aback, and it wasn't really clear what mental state, I think, Putin was in and what the decision-making process was. And most importantly, they were clearly concerned about the prospect of a NATO intervention, and so were trying to signal very heavily and engage in forms of nuclear saber-rattling to try to deter it. Although in practice, I don't think the U.S. ever observed any changes in Russian nuclear readiness or force posture, neither in the spring nor later in the fall, which I'm about to get to. And that's very important to convey to people. is that I saw on the internet and amongst think tanks and other commentators a conversation take off that in practice wasn't matched by any observed Russian signaling, the kind of things you would expect to see if the Russian leadership wanted to communicate to the United States and to other countries who generally are assumed to have the means of assessing and observing these sort of changes, that they in fact were moving closer to nuclear use or changing nuclear force posture or changing readiness levels and what have you. Now, let's get briefly to October. So my interpretation is that when Russia suffered an unexpected defeat in Kharkiv and their forces were forced to rout, they were also simultaneously being pressed in Kherson, although the initial Ukraine offensive in Kherson wasn't all that successful. And Russian forces were ultimately able to withdraw in late October, early November. But what took place around October was sort of two different conversations. One conversation took place kind of online again amongst folks who follow these issues as Russian signaling, public signaling increased significantly, although I did not hear of anybody assessing a substantial change in Russian force readiness or posture. But the matter really came down to the belief that if Russian forces faced a collapse along the front line, that is, they were forced to rout in Kharkiv and they were forced to retreat in Kherson, and with Russian political leadership under pressure, then the military would propose one of the few options available other than facing, you know, a catastrophic defeat in Ukraine, which is employing nuclear weapons in some way, shape, or form. First. Second, there was some signaling on the Russian side regarding the prospect of Ukraine employing a radiological device, okay? And this looked like them searching for a pretext of a false flag attack that they might make, which they could then use as the actual causability or the reason for their own employment of nuclear weapons, right? And so it looked like they were building kind of a story or a narrative, and that's what got people a lot more concerned. The reason it looked that way, from my own point of view, is because they intended it to look that way, because they were hoping that the United States and other countries might try to restrain either Ukraine or might curtail their assistance to Ukraine in this critical moment when the Russian armed forces were at their weakest, right? And so this form of messaging was actually meant to convey to us that they might be searching for a pretext. I don't think any of it amounted to very much, and I don't agree with some of the journalistic coverage I saw that suggested the United States actually tried to restrain Ukraine. I don't think we did, and I don't think that's actually true, nor could we have in that moment. And ultimately, there was no collapse of the Russian front line. There wasn't even really a collapse of Russian position in Kherson. They conducted a fairly orderly withdrawal during that time period. But I think that was the most, the heightened period of risk and perceived risk, certainly on our side, and naturally led to a lot of deliberations, some of which, at least from what I understand from New York Times reporting and what you just discussed in Jim Shido's recent coverage. But I think that period focuses specifically on October and November.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the timing that I had seen as well. But I think your point about narratives is a really important one here, because with Putin's nuclear, you know, the term nuclear saber rattling gets used a lot, but it's a useful one. It's making it somewhat difficult at times, though, to separate the rhetoric from reality and thinking about what is the message that Putin is trying to send? What does he want us to think? What is the kind of risk perception that he's trying to generate? Because risk manipulation is just seems to be such an essential part of Russia's strategy. And Putin is banking on the West having a lower risk tolerance and eventually getting deterred and pushed out of this. And, you know, I'd be curious on your thoughts about that. But with regards to this rhetoric versus reality, at the time, did you see any situations on the ground where Russia would have militarily benefited from a use of like a low yield tactical nuclear weapon?
Yeah, of course. I mean, tactical nuclear weapons have different roles. What I basically saw was, I would say, a not so smart conversation take place in commentary circles that looked like people were trying to retcon the entire history of development of nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy to convince themselves that tactical nuclear weapons had no battlefield use And the United States, Russia, and the Soviet Union, and other countries had developed them kind of on a lark as Christmas ornaments over the course of these decades, and that there's no practical application for them for the actual purpose that they are built, which is very much not the case, right? So from my point of view, yes, absolutely. There could have been a clear-cut benefit to employment tactical nuclear weapons, either potentially on the battlefield along key concentration of forces, or against critically important targets behind the front line, or against critical supporting infrastructure, logistics, bridging, what have you. And let's be clear, Russia's arsenal of non-strategic nuclear weapons, which includes sort of tactical nuclear weapons, those that are fall into the tactical operational category in terms of ranges and targets they're likely to be employed against, and those that can be even used in more extensive ranges or targets much further behind tactical operational depths, that arsenal in a number of respects rivals Russia's arsenal of strategic nuclear weapons, right? And it's probably quite far more diverse. And I do believe it is an arsenal that is well maintained, contrary to some of the arguments I heard back then, which were part and parcel of that same narrative of, well, maybe these things are old. Well, they don't refurbish them and they don't look at the warheads. They don't do these things. And there's a lot of people kind of seemingly gaslighting themselves and telling themselves lots of things I don't think are actually true. Not that people should have been that worried or scared necessarily, because again, behind their messaging, there was nothing there to suggest a growing increase in Russian readiness or determination or an actual change in their forces. Although you could counter-argue and say that if they had made those decisions, that could have all happened fairly quickly, right? That's a fair counter-argument to make. But nonetheless, meaning if they wanted to signal that truthfully, they could have done it in very easily observable ways to the United States and to a number of other countries that have the ability to observe those sort of movements. But yeah, no, I think definitely that that was a prospect. The challenge is, and this is my own view, is that when it comes to crossing the nuclear threshold, the political costs of using a nuclear weapon, no matter the type, and even in some respects, doesn't really matter if it's directly on the battlefield or if it's against critically supporting infrastructure behind the battlefield, the cost would be very high. But they would rise very significantly from the first case of nuclear use, and they might potentially then level off very significantly with all subsequent cases of nuclear use. Meaning, to put it more glibly and simply, I think that in case of tactical nuclear weapon employment, there is no simple I win button where one tactical nuclear weapon would have done it. That's very true. But 20, 30, 40 might have. And it is a bit of a case of in for a penny, in for a pound in terms of the cost you're likely to pay between the first nuclear weapon and the other 20. All right. Now, there are obviously a lot of nuances and complexities into that conversation. I'm trying to put it as simply as I can in a matter of a few seconds. But so this is the problem I have, is that folks were trying to say, well, they'd have to use more than one. Well, they have upwards of 2,000, so it's not like they were going to run out of 20.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on a really important paradox here, which is on the one hand, we didn't see any readiness, any changes in readiness. We didn't see the movements that we would have if they were preparing for nuclear use. At the same time, it's nuclear weapons. Like, they're scary, and we have to take these threats seriously. I also think you're right on the kind of quality, so to speak, of Russian tactical nuclear weapons. The Russians say that they've finished modernization like 80 to 90%. And so these, you know, these aren't things that have necessarily been like sitting unattended to for decades. There have been has been a lot of modernization going on the Russian side. But to your other point about how many would be used, you know, I think you and I might disagree on that one slightly, because one of the big question marks around that time was about what was the international reaction to Russia's nuclear threats. And it seems that one of the things that might have prevented Russia from escalating and potentially using nuclear weapons was a response from India and China. And so if there was that type of a response and warning to Putin just to be talking about nuclear use, I would hope that we would anticipate that the international community would really rise up against a single nuclear use and try to reestablish that norm and kind of try to put the genie back in the bottle. But I suspect you disagree with that.
If you're tired of hearing ads, you can support the show by becoming a member. This week, Listeners of the DSR Network shows can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, and early access to select podcasts. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSRNetwork, one word, to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSRNetwork. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, March 16th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
I don't agree with that. But here's what I look at. So I think there are many potential cases of nuclear employment, right? Demonstration use of various types, demonstration use with some possible effects, but without significant destruction or loss of human life. But of course, when we come to battlefield nuclear employment, that's where the challenge you get into is using one nuclear weapon, why I said multiple would be required to achieve anything. Nuclear weapons are not an easy I win button, right? They have very significant destructive effects and very significant consequences outside of conventional weapons. And I want to add a point to this before I get to the issue that we disagree on. One thing I get frustrated is that folks forget there is a reason why we try to engage in arms control and why we talk about stability with regarding to nuclear weapons. Okay. And they forget that it is because of the consequences of their use and the potential utility of their use, right? And sometimes the same folks then say that they have no actual utility. Well, if they have no utility and there are no benefits derived from them, then why is there such a large industry surrounding the question of arms control, stability, confidence building measures, and what have you, right? So these things must be important for something, right? They must do something. If there's so much effort been involved since their development in trying to control them, manage them, and make sure that they don't get used, right? So I'll just point that point out there as something that I myself have an axe to grind on. But to the issue we disagree on, so look, I personally think that there is absolutely no way that if Russian forces are facing a cascade collapse along the front line and their only option to avert this defeat is the potential of using nuclear weapons, that Putin remotely cares what India and China thinks. He didn't care what China think when he invaded Ukraine. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking involved in parts of the communities that are in this conversation in believing that when it comes to first order interests, right, core interests, such as being defeated in a major conventional war with implications for the survival of your own regime, that Putin's really gonna stay up at night and wonder what India and China and these other countries think. And if it's between defeat using nuclear weapons, that the first order question being debated is, well, what do the Chinese think? They maybe won't like it. I'm sorry. I just see no evidence of it. I actually see no evidence of that on lower tier questions. Like, does Russia really care about Chinese interests when they chose to invade Ukraine? Do they really care about India's interests all that much when it comes to their own priorities? The answer to that has fairly consistently been no. Why would they care about it when it comes to nuclear use? And then lastly, there's another point. I'm sorry, folks listening to this, because they're probably hoping that, yes, the world exists where leaders are staying up at night, really concerned about what China and India are going to do in their political response. And I'm sure it is a factor, because this all gets built into the political costs you pay from using nuclear weapons, the presumed political costs you pay, right? But the other issue you have is that, as we see fairly consistently, leaders have big assumptions on what they think the costs actually will be, and they're often wrong. And part of the reason we are dealing with this war is that Russian leadership's assumptions of the costs that they would pay from the international community have consistently been wrong. And the issue that folks have is they assume a fair rationalization of the calculus of leaders, and that they have the same assumptions about the costs they will face from countries like China and India that they think they will face. I hope this makes sense what I'm trying to say, but that's not true. And a lot about Putin's actions in recent years suggest that his interpretation of the costs and risks are rather different from those of a lot of analysts trying to assess his interpretation.
So we'll have to continue this bigger debate at another time, but I will agree with your, I think the point you're making at the end, which is there's probably a lot of mirror imaging and wishful thinking going on the part of the West in some of the assumptions that we are making, particularly about Putin. And, you know, I try to always say this, like any conversation about Russian decision-making, we should probably approach with a degree of humility because nobody actually knows what's going on in that man's mind. I have one question I've been really, I'm really dying to ask you, and it might have to be our last one as I know we might have to wrap up soon, but what are the Ukrainians saying about nuclear risk? Do they feel a more acute nuclear risk, whether it was during that time in fall 2022 or now? Is there any sort of civilian preparedness being done in the event of nuclear weapons use?
Yeah, so I sense from the Ukrainian side a significant degree of bluster, basically seeing that Russian nuclear threats or risks were simply meant to deter further Western support, that they were likely a bluff, and that bottom line, even if Russia did use tactical nuclear weapons, their position was that this wouldn't significantly alter the war, which I think is actually wrong, technically. It quite would, and we actually see that at the scale which forces are employed on the battlefield in Ukraine, it wouldn't really take that many nuclear weapons at all to significantly stop an offensive. But we'll put that aside. There's just a Dr. Strangelove technical conversation that we don't need to have right now. But I thought their overall view of it was fairly dismissive at the time. And I'm not sure that it was dismissive for the right reasons. But nonetheless, that was my impression of it. I don't know about any Ukrainian sort of preparedness for Russian nuclear use. To be very frank, all those formations that were widespread and existed in Soviet forces have been eliminated from Ukrainian forces, meaning CBRN type formations that whose job it is to deal with potential nuclear use and to address forces or the parts of the battlefield contaminated from it. So the force structure and the capacity wasn't there in the first place. And those formations exist on the Russian side, but many of them have been converted for other purposes as well. And I won't say that either force is especially well prepared for nuclear employment, but definitely the Russian force is prepared for nuclear employment much more so than any other, given the fact that they actually have tactical nuclear weapons of various types and doctrinally have... let's put it this way, doctrinally have the sort of the plans and concepts of operations for their use. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't have much more to add on it. It's not an area I significantly explored in my conversation with Ukrainians. To me, if anything, it was very interesting to kind of see the broader conversation on it as, okay, let's not have the risk of nuclear use overly deter us, which I think was right because there actually wasn't much observable behind that risk, if that makes sense, in terms of Russian actual actions that would meaningfully signal an intention to deploy nuclear weapons. But then I also saw a great deal of a conversation that I could only describe in modern parlance as gaslighting. And I don't think it was especially helpful in trying to rewrite what we know about nuclear weapons and how they work and the implications of their use on the battlefield either. And that was particularly more probably amongst European colleagues. At least that's my impression of it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you do keep reinforcing this point that we didn't see any kind of movement on the ground that would necessarily be more a cause for greater concern. Then final question, what would be cause for concern for you? Would it be to seeing those changes in readiness levels? Would it be Russia facing a massive defeat? Or what would be the scenario in which you would be a little bit more worried about possible nuclear weapons use?
Sure. So just to put my cards on the table, I'm a person who believes much less in the risk of accidental escalation, as you know, Heather. And I'm not a big believer in accidental war theory either. And I'm not a strong believer in the likelihood of accidental nuclear use, except in crisis scenarios where one or both sides believe that the other side would want to or would need to employ nuclear weapons, right? Such as, let's say, in a conventional war, a major standoff between nuclear powers where intentions are really unclear and certain things can be misinterpreted. So with that in mind, I thought that to me, this was a conditions-based consideration that the likelihood of Russian nuclear use, either outside of the prospect of direct intervention of U.S. NATO forces that would bring them into a conventional conflict with the Russian military, that the only likelihood, that the only real prospect was a set of conditions in which not only was the Russian military defeated in a particular operation, but it was defeated in such a way there would be a loss of cohesion of Russian forces across the theater, what I referred to earlier as a cascade collapse, making the entire further military effort unsustainable. And the nature of the collapse, right, was such that it would create a pressured decision-making situation in Moscow that is time pressure, which is where the risk really grows, right? If forces are in steady retreat, but they are able to withdraw in details what happened in Kherson, yes, you're defeated in the battle, but you don't have to make pressured decisions. You don't have to make decisions under the risk that the entire front might collapse, yeah? And so this is where I thought the risk was heightened. And I think that the situation, first and foremost, never presented itself, although it looked closest to take place maybe in October 2022. But in reality, this didn't take place. And by November, it was very clearly that it wasn't going to take place, just from my point of view. And I was in Ukraine late in October myself back then, in Kherson, actually personally at the time. And on the other part of it, I don't think there were any, just from what I know from public reporting, and maybe much more will come out in stories like Jim Sciutto's, I don't think there was any really observed movement or change in the disposition of Russian nuclear forces or anything that we might have detected as being communicated to Russian nuclear forces, right? And so that's kind of where I leave it. And so I felt that the conversation about it ran, you know, far ahead of what was really kind of happening on the ground in terms of the actual risk. And one last point I want to make. One thing that folks should consider whenever they're taking in Russian public messaging, what we refer to kind of colloquially as saber rattling, is that there's a great deal of public messaging on nuclear weapons in Russia by Putin and others that's aimed at the Russian domestic audience. Don't forget that Russia is a large country with a lot of people, and not everything's about the United States or about Western audiences. And so this is red meat for a very particular audience. And when things are not going well, they usually trot out a lot of people to remind everyone that Russia's a nuclear power, that Russia can destroy the West, you know, whenever it wants to, yada, yada. And the reason they do this is for their own domestic audiences, right? So not everything is necessarily just aimed at us. And folks forget that because we're operating the same information environment. So you can see, you know, the Russian TV and what have you. And they forget that there's a big internal audience amongst Russian elites and the Russian public for this kind of like rah-rah jingoist messaging surrounding Russia's nuclear status.
So I think we'll have to leave it there. It's not all about us, and we should be reminding ourselves of that. But Mike, thank you so much for helping us unpack this latest news, but also kind of the ongoing risks of escalation and potential nuclear use in Ukraine. A really great conversation, and hope you'll come back and chat with John and I sometime. But that wraps it up for this week's episode of We're All Gonna Die. Thanks. Bye-bye.